sized perfectly to wrap around my throat, with a couple of wider bits left over for handholds. I held it up, making a bit of drama out of it as I turned in a circle and said, "Out of respect for our host and her law, there shall be no bloodshed." Then I tossed the tie to the icy floor halfway between myself and the red cap. I looked up at Maeve and gave my chin an arrogant little lift. "Sup, princess? You game?" Maeve lifted one hand and idly began tracing a fingertip over her lips, her eyes bright. She looked at Red and nodded. "Okay, chucklehead," I said, turning to face him. "How about you let the Yeti there hold the girl while you and I dance?" I gave him a broad grin. "Unless you're afraid of little old cockroach swatting me." Red's upper lip twitched. If he hadn't been one of the she, and at a party, and in front of all of his dearest frenemies, he would have snarled at me. He beckoned the ogre with one hand, and the thing lumbered over to him. He thrust Sarissa into its huge, hairy, meaty arms. The ogre didn't get the girl around the neck. It simply wrapped its hand over her skull, like some hairy, spidery helmet, and held on. The smoky glass chopsticks in Sarissa's hair clattered to the ice, and her eyes got even wider. "If the wizard uses his magic," the red cap said, "break her neck." He eyed the ogre and said, "without ripping it off."
"Yeah,"
the ogre said. Its beady eyes glared at me. The red cap nodded and turned to face me. His eyes narrowed. "Youch. Nice move on Red's part, though I'm not sure he needed to bother. I'd never been able to tag one of the she with a really solid hit with my magic. Their defenses against that kind of thing were just too damn good. But I'd been counting on using it indirectly to help out in the fight, and the red cap had just taken that option away from me. Sarissa gave the red cap a glare that might have peeled paint from a wall, and then said, her voice rasping,
"Harry, you don't have to do this for me. You can walk away."
"You kidding?" I said under my breath. "You think I'm going to go to all the trouble of finding a new PT guy? Hang tough." She bit her lip and nodded. I dismissed the girl from my thoughts as much as I could and tried to focus. I was still better off than I'd been a few moments ago. Now, instead of a 3-versus-1 fight that would probably kill me and certainly kill Sarissa, I had a pure 1-on-1. If I lost, Sarissa wouldn't make it, and I would either be Maeve's chew toy or dead. I was hoping for dead. But if I won, Sarissa and I both got to walk away. It wouldn't keep something like this from happening again, but we'd live through the night, which was by definition victory. Of course, now I had to win without using magic in a strangling cord duel against a fairy who was faster than me and who had centuries of experience in killing mortals. Oh, and I had to win it without drawing blood, or I'd be guilty of breaking Mab's law, and I knew how she would react to that. Mab wasn't evil, exactly, but she was Mab. She'd have me torn apart. The only mercy she would show would be by doing it all at once instead of spread over weeks. Long story short, nobody there was going to help me. At times it sucks to be the lone hero guy. I had one advantage. I was used to competing out of my weight class. I didn't have a whole ton of training in unarmed combat, but I did have considerable experience with being in dicey situations against homicide-oriented people and things that were bigger than me, stronger than me, faster than me, and motivated to end my life. I knew how to fight an uphill battle. The red cap knew how to kill, but by maneuvering me out of using my magic, he tipped some of his hand. He was being cautious about me. Sure, he was a predator. But in nature, predators usually go after the weak, the sick, the aged, and the isolated. Solitary predators almost exclusively hunt by attacking from surprise, where they have every advantage in their favor. Hell, even great white sharks do that, and they're just about the biggest, oldest predators on the planet. I've seen a lot of things that hunted people in my time, and I regard them as a professional hazard, part of the job. I know how they operate. Predators don't like to pick fair fights. It runs counter to their nature and robs them of many of their advantages. The Red Cap had tried to limit what I could do in a bid to scrape together any advantage he could, as any predator does. That told me that he probably wasn't used to this kind of open confrontation. He was nervous. I was nervous, too. But I was on familiar psychological ground, and he wasn't. Maybe I could use that. I undid the top button of the shirt and shrugged out of the jacket as if nothing at all were about to happen, taking my time. I tossed it at one of the watching Shi. He caught it and folded it neatly over one arm, never looking away, while I calmly undid the cuffs of my shirt and rolled up the sleeves. I stowed the cufflinks in a pocket. I stretched and yawned, which might have been taking the pantomime over the top, but what the hell. In for a penny. I smiled at Maeve, inclined my head very slightly to Mab, and turned to face the Red Cap. "Ready," I said. "Ready," the Red Cap echoed. The music abruptly stopped, and in the silence Mab's voice came from everywhere. "Begin!" I rushed forward faster than I ever could have done before I became Mab's knight. It was damn close. The Red Cap was quicker off the mark, but I had longer arms. He snatched the nearest end of the silk an instant before I grabbed my end. As my fingers closed, he snapped it back out of my grip and then dropped his weight straight down, his back leg coming forward into a crescent-shaped sweep about 6 inches off the icy floor. I turned my forward stumble into a forward roll. I went over the kick, tucked in tight, and came up to my feet smoothly. But the motion had carried me past him, and I knew that with his speed and grace, he'd already be leaping toward my back. I spun to him, one hand at the level of my throat to intercept him if he was already close enough to get the tie around it, and lunged back toward him with my right arm raised to the horizontal, hoping to catch him across the neck in a clothesline. I'd misjudged. He was moving so fast that all I got was motion blur, and he hadn't swept the silk tie at my neck. He'd aimed for my upraised left hand. The silk snaked around my wrist, and I caught it in my hand just in time for him to slip to one side, dragging my arm in close to his body. He used my forward momentum and my trapped arm to rob me of my balance and spin me in a circle, hauling at my arm with all his strength. His strength was considerable, and his technique was sound. He suddenly reversed, using my own motion against me, and dislocated my arm from its shoulder socket with a loud pop and a flash of red-hot pain.
"Harry!"
Sarissa screamed, grabbing uselessly at the ogre's wrist. It was as thick as her own leg, and the ogre didn't even seem to notice her struggling. The Red Cap kept hold of my arm, my wrist pulled up against his sternum and still trapped in the tie. He smiled broadly and walked backward in a small circle, the pain and the leverage forcing me to scramble along the floor in front of him. A gale of lovely, cold laughter went up from the Shi like a chorus of frozen chimes. The Red Cap took a miniature, mocking bow to the crowd and spoke to me.
"I was worried for a moment, mortal. You're faster than you look."
He kicked me in the dislocated shoulder. He wasn't trying to kick my arm off. He was just doing it for the hell of it. It hurt a lot.
"You should see the look on your face, mortal," the Red Cap said. "This is fun."
"You know what, Red?" I gasped. "We're all having fun."
I took my weight onto my knees and back and slammed the heel of my right hand into the side of the jackass's knee. I didn't know how much stronger Mab's gift had made me, because I'd never been much of a weightlifter until I started therapy. I didn't know too much about how much weightlifters could, for example, bench press, so I didn't have a very good idea how I stacked up against plain old me, or plain old anybody. Plus, the weights for the bench press were marked in metric units, and I kind of fell asleep the day we learned to convert them to pounds. But I'm pretty sure 400 kilos isn't bad. The Red Cap's knee popped like a balloon from the force of the strike, and bent in toward his other knee. He howled in startled agony and tried to throw himself away, but just as I hadn't been able to move for a few critical seconds after he'd injured me, His body wasn't responding properly either, and he fell next to me. The left side of my body felt like it was on fire, but me and Payne are old buddies. His grip on the tie had loosened, and I couldn't move my left arm enough to get it loose. So before he could recover, I punched him in the neck with my good hand. He gagged and thrashed, and I was able to unwrap the silk from my useless arm. I tried to pull the tie away from him, but he'd already shaken off the hits I'd given him and held on. I jerked on it as hard as I could, but I had only the one arm and was fresh out of leverage. I could feel the tie sliding through my fingers. So I let go, without warning, and snapped my hand at a different target as he fell back. He dropped into a backward roll and came up 6 feet away. He perched on one hand and a knee, still gripping the tie. I casually settled his red ball cap onto my head, touched a forefinger to its brim, winked at him, and said, "You have hat hair." Again there was a chorus of marrow-curdling laughter from the she. It wasn't any more pleasant to have them laughing with me than it had been to have them laughing at me. The red cap's face flushed a furious red, and I could see the blood vessels in his eyes bursting. Hell's bells. The twit hadn't been particularly perturbed when I crippled his leg, but touch his hat and embarrass him in front of his peers, and the dude flipped out. Nobody has their priorities straight anymore. I made it to my feet before he simply leapt at me. He hit me before I could get my balance, and we both went down, his eyes burning. He ignored the tie and latched onto my throat with both hands. He was strong. I think I might have been stronger than he was, but I had only the one arm. I slammed it at his forearms. If he kept his grip on me, those nails would almost certainly draw blood. He hissed and jerked his hands away at the last second, and I slammed my knee against his injured leg. I bucked him off me while he screamed. I went after him. We rolled a couple of times, and I cannot tell you how much it hurt both of us to do it. He had the use of both arms. I was able to use both legs to stabilize myself, but he was a hell of a lot squirmier than me, and in a blur of confusing motion, he somehow managed to slither around to my back and get an arm across my throat. I got a few fingers underneath it and started trying to pry him away. It wasn't a winning move. I managed to lessen the pressure, but I couldn't pull him off me, and my head started to pound. Another group inhalation went up from the she, and I could feel them leaning closer. Their interest almost frenzied, hundreds and hundreds of gem-like eyes sparkling like stars as the light started dimming. Sarissa stared at me with wide eyes, her expression horrified. But she'd lost one of her shoes. I watched as she reached out with her toes and managed to pluck one of her fallen glassy chopsticks up off the floor. The freaking Yeti holding her didn't notice. It was staring far too intently at the fight. Sarissa passed the chopstick up to her hands, gripped it with both of them, and snapped it in the middle. Shattered pieces of black glass fell away from a slender steel rod. Without looking, she simply lifted her hand and pressed the rod against the underside of the Yeti's wrist. Fairies, be they she or any other kind, cannot abide the touch of iron. To them it's worse than molten plutonium. It burns them like fire, scars them, poisons them. There's a lot of folklore about cold iron, and it's a widely held belief that it refers only to cold-forged iron, but that's a bunch of hooey. When the old stories refer to cold iron, they're being poetic, like when they say hot lead. If you want to hurt one of the Fae, you just need iron, including any alloy containing it to hurt them. And man, does it ever hurt them. The ogre's wrist burst into a sudden coruscation of yellow-white flame, as bright as that of an arc welder. The ogre howled and jerked its arm away from Sarissa's head, as if he'd been a child experimenting with a penny and an electrical outlet. Sarissa spun on her heel and slashed the little steel rod across the ogre's thigh. It howled in primal fury and flinched back, sweeping one long arm at her in pure reflex. Sarissa caught only a tiny fraction of the blow, but it was enough to send her staggering. She fell only a couple of feet away from me and looked up, her eyes dazed. Her lower lip had been split wide open. A large ruby droplet fell from her lip and hung in the air, shining and perfect, and stayed there for half of forever. Then it finally splashed down onto the icy floor. There was a shrieking hiss as the blood hit the supernatural ice, a sound somewhere between a hot skillet and a high-pressure industrial accident. The ice beneath the drop of blood shattered, as if it had been unimaginably heavy, and a web of dark crack shot out for 50 feet in every direction. The music stopped. The red cap froze. So did everyone else. Mab rose out of her chair, and somehow in that instant of action she crossed the distance from her high seat, as though the simple act of standing up were what propelled her to the space nearby. As she came, the pallid finery of her dress darkened to raven black, as if the air had contained a fine mist of ink. Her hair darkened as well to the same color, and her eyes turned entirely black, sclera and all, as did her nails. The skin seemed to cling harder to her bones, making her beautiful features gaunt and terrible. The red cap flinched away from me and dragged himself back with his arms getting clear. Give credit where it's due. He might have been a sadistic, bloodthirsty monster, but he wasn't a stupid one. The furious, burned ogre wasn't bright enough to realize what was happening. Still smoldering, still enraged, it came stomping toward Sarissa. "Night!" Mab said, the word a whip-crack. Maeve came to the edge of the platform and clutched her hands into fists, her mouth twisted into a snarl. I didn't get up off the ground. There wasn't time. Instead, I focused my will upon the advancing ogre and funneled my anger and my pain into the spell, along with the frozen core of power within me. I unleashed the energy as I thundered,
"Vintas servitas!"
The ogre was only a couple of yards from Sarissa when the gale of arctic wind I'd called up slammed into the thing and lifted its massive bulk completely off the ground. It tossed the ogre a good 10 feet away. It landed in a tumble, dug its claws into the ice, and fought its way back to its feet. I rose from the ground, acutely conscious of Mab's black presence just over my left shoulder, of the watching eyes of the winter court. I'd told Sarissa this was my first day in prison, and the yard was full of things that could and would kill me if they got the chance. It was time for an object lesson. I reached down into the cold inside of me. It was painful to touch that power, like throwing yourself into icy water, like emerging from warm covers into the shuddering cold of an unheated apartment on a winter morning. I didn't like it, but I knew how to get it. All I had to do was think about everyone I'd let down, everyone I'd left behind back in Chicago. My brother, Thomas, my apprentice, Molly, my friends, my daughter, Karen. I thought about them, and it felt like something in my chest was starting to tear in half. The winter inside me was torment and agony, but at least when I was immersed in it, I couldn't feel. I lifted my right arm, the side that projects energy, focused my will, and shouted,
"Infriga!"
There was a flash of light, an arctic howl, a scream of air suddenly condensed into liquid, and an explosion of frost and fog centered upon the ogre. The air became a solid fog bank, a rolling mist, and for several seconds there was silence. I waited for the mist to disperse, and after several long seconds it began to clear away, swept along by the remnants of the gale I had called first. When it cleared, the entire winter court could see the ogre, standing crouched, just as it had been when I threw the spell at it. I waited for a moment more, letting everyone see the ogre, standing absolutely still in defiance of Mab's law. Then I drew forth my will again, extended my hand, and snarled,
"Forzari!"
A lance of invisible power lashed out at the ogre, and when it struck, the frozen monster shattered into thousands of icy chunks, the largest of which was about the size of my fist. The bits of the former ogre exploded over several hundred square yards of the dance floor, and grisly frozen shrapnel pelted the watching she and sent them reeling back with shouts of alarm. The she gathered themselves again, and every one of those bright eyes locked onto me, their expressions alien, unreadable. From one of the back corners I heard a deep, heartily amused chuckle rolling through the air. Kringle, I thought. I turned to Mab and almost spoke, but then I remembered her other law and closed my mouth. Mab's mouth twitched in an approving micro-smile, and she nodded her head at me. "If you consent, I would speak to them." She stared at me with those black carrion bird eyes and nodded. First I helped Sarissa to her feet, passing her a clean white handkerchief, which she immediately pressed to her mouth. I gave her what I hoped was a reassuring smile. Then I took a deep breath and turned to address the room, turning in a slow circle as I spoke to be sure I included everyone. My voice echoed throughout the whole chamber as clearly as if I'd been using a PA system. "All right, you primitive screwheads, listen up. I'm Harry Dresden. I'm the new Winter Knight. I'm instituting a rule. When you're within sight of me, mortals are off limits." I paused for a moment to let that sink in. Then I continued. "I can't give you orders. I can't control what you do in your own domains. I'm not going to be able to change you. I'm not even going to try. But if I see you abusing a mortal, you'll join Chunky here. Zero warnings, zero excuses, sub-zero tolerance." I paused again and then asked, "Any questions?" One of the she smirked and stepped forward, his leather pants creaking. He opened his mouth, his expression condescending.
"Mortal, do you actually think that you can—"
"Infriga!"
I snarled, unleashing Winter again, and without waiting for the cloud to clear, hurled the second strike, shouting,
"Forzare!"
This time I aimed much of the force up. Grisly bits of frozen she-noble came pattering and clattering down to the ice of the dance floor. When the mist cleared, the she looked stunned, even Maeve.
"I'm glad you asked me that," I said to the space where the she-lord had been standing. "I hope my answer clarified any misunderstandings."
I looked left and right, seeking out eyes, but didn't find any willing to meet mine.
"Are there any other questions?"
There was a vast and empty silence, broken only by Kringle's continued rumbles of amusement.
"Daughter," Mab said calmly, "your lackey shamed me as the host of this gathering. I hold you accountable. You will return to Arctis Minora at once, there to await my pleasure."
Maeve stared at Mab, her eyes cold. Then she spun in a glitter of gems and began striding away. Several dozen of the she, including the red cap and the raw head, followed her. Mab turned to Sarissa and said in a much calmer voice,
"Honestly, Iron?" "I apologize, my queen," Sarissa said. "I'll dispose of it safely."
"See that you do," Mab said.
"Now, I would have a dance. Sir Knight?"
I blinked, but didn't hesitate for more than an instant or three. My arm seems to be an obstacle." Mab smiled and laid a hand upon my shoulder. My arm popped back into its socket with a silver shock of sensation, and the pain dwindled to almost nothing. I rolled my shoulder, testing it. If it wasn't exactly comfortable, it seemed to work well enough. I turned to Mab, bowed, and stepped closer to her as the music rose again. It was a waltz. While the stunned she looked on, I waltzed with Mab to a full orchestral version of Shinedown's 45. And the smaller bits of our enemies crunched beneath our feet. Oddly enough, no one joined us. Dancing with Mab was like dancing with a shadow. She moved so gracefully, so lightly, that had my eyes been closed, I might not have been able to tell that she was there at all. I felt lumbering and clumsy beside her, but managed not to trip over my own feet.
"That was well done, wizard,"
Mab murmured.
"No one has lifted a hand of them that way since the days of Tam Lin."
"I wanted them to understand the nature of our relationship."
"It would seem you succeeded," she murmured. "The next time they come at you, they will not do it so openly."
"I'll handle it."
"I expect nothing less," Mab said. "In the future, try to avoid being at such a stark disadvantage. Sarissa may not be there to rescue you a second time."
I grunted. Then I frowned and said, "You wanted this to happen tonight. It wasn't just about me staring down your nobles. You're setting something into motion." Her lips quirked slightly at one corner in approval. "I chose well. You are ready, my knight. It is time for me to give you my first command." I swallowed and tried not to look nervous. "Oh?" The song came to a close with Mab standing very close to me, lifting her head slightly to whisper into my ear. The she applauded politely and without enthusiasm, but the sound was enough to muffle what she whispered into my ear.
"Wizard," she said, her breathy voice trembling, every syllable bubbled with venom, with hate. "Kill my daughter. Kill Maeve."
Chapter 8. Dancing with Mab was like rapidly downing shots of well-aged whiskey. Being that close to her beauty, to her bottomless eyes, hit me pretty hard. The scent of her, cool and clean and intoxicating, lingered in my nose, a disorienting pleasure. I'd thrown around a lot of energy to pull off the pair of chunk-making combos, and between that and Mab's proximity, I was having a little trouble walking a straight line after the dance. It wasn't like I had feelings for her. I didn't feel the kind of low pulse of physical attraction that I would around a pretty woman. I didn't particularly like her. I sure as hell didn't feel any love for her. It was simply impossible to be that close to her, to that kind of deadly power and beauty, to that kind of immortal hunger and desire, without it rattling the bars of my cage. Mab wasn't human, and wasn't meant for human company. I had no doubt whatsoever in my mind that long-term exposure to her would have serious, unpleasant side effects. And never mind what she had just asked me to do. The consequences of that kind of action would be really, really huge. And only an idiot would willingly involve himself in direct action on a scale that significant. Which really didn't say anything good about me, given how often I'd been the guy wearing the idiot's shoes. After our dance, Mab returned to her high seat and surveyed the chamber through barely open eyes, a distant figure now garbed in pure white and untouchable again. As my head came out of the cold, numb clarity of wielding winter, the aches and pains the red cap had given me began to resurface in a big way. Fatigue began piling up, and when I looked around for a place to sit down, I found Cat Sith sitting nearby, his wide eyes patient and opaque.
"Sir Knight," the Malk said, "you do not suffer fools."
There was the faintest hint of approval in his tone.
"What is your need?"
"I've had enough party," I said. "Would it inconvenience the Queen for me to depart?"
"If she wished you to stay, you would be at her side,"
Cat Sith replied.
"And it would seem that you have introduced yourself adequately."
"Good. If you do not mind," I said, "please ask Sarissa to join me."
"I do not mind,"
Cat Sith said in a decidedly approving tone. He vanished into the party and appeared a few moments later, leading Sarissa. She walked steadily enough, though she still had my handkerchief pressed to her mouth. "You want to get out of here?" I asked her.
It's a good idea, she said. Most of the VIPs left after your dance. Things will devolve from here.
Devolve? I asked.
I don't care to stay, she said, her tone careful. I would prefer to leave. I frowned and then realized that she was trying to get a read on me. I simultaneously became acutely aware of a number of she-ladies who were, I would say lurking, except that you don't generally use that word with someone so beautiful. There were half a dozen of them, though, who were staying nearby and whose eyes were tracking me. I felt disconcertingly reminded of a documentary I'd once seen about lionesses involved in a cooperative hunt. There was something about them that was very similar. One, a ravishing dark-haired beauty wearing leather pants and strategically applied electrical tape, stared hard at me, and when she saw me looking, licked her lips very, very slowly. She trailed a fingertip over her chin, down across her throat, and down over her sternum, and gave me a smile so wicked that its parents should have sent it to military school. Oh, I said, understanding. Despite my fatigue, my throat felt dry and my heart revved up a bit. Devolving. I'll go, Sarissa said. I don't expect anything from you simply because we arrived together. A Sith lady with deep indigo blue hair had sidled up to Miss Electrical Tape, and the two slid their arms around each other, both staring at me. Something inside me, and I'd be lying if I said that none of it was mine, let out a primal snarl and advised me to drag both of them back to my cave by the hair and do whatever I damn well pleased with them. It was an enormously powerful impulse, something that made me begin to shift my balance, to take a step toward them. I arrested the motion and closed my eyes. Yeah, I said. Yeah, they look great, but that isn't a fantasy come true, Harry. That's a wood chipper in Playboy bunny clothing. I shook my head and turned deliberately away from temptation before I opened my eyes again. We'll both go, I said to Sarissa. It'd be a bad idea to stay. I offered her my arm. She frowned thoughtfully at me for a moment before she put her hand on my arm. We left again, preceded by Cat Sith. Once we were in the icy hallways, she asked me, Why?
Why what?
Leave, she said. You wanted to stay. And let's just say that the appetite of she-ladies has never been overstated. And nothing excites them more than violence and power. There are men who would literally kill to have the opportunity you just passed up.
Probably, I said. Morons.
Then why turn it down, she asked.
Because I'm not a goddamn sex doll.
That's a good reason to avoid attention that is forced on you, she said. But that isn't what happened. Why pass up what they were offering?
We walked for a while before I answered. I've already made one choice that took everything away from me, I said. I don't know how much longer I'll be around, or how much of a life I can make for myself now. But I'm going to live as much of it as I can as my own man, not somebody's prison bitch. Not the flavor of the day.
Ah, she said, and frowned faintly. I blinked several times and suddenly realized what she'd been trying to find out.
Oh, you're wondering if I turned them down because I was planning to have you instead.
She gave me an oblique look. I wouldn't have phrased it that way.
I snorted. I'm not. She nodded.
Why not?
Does it matter? I asked.
Why always matters?
It was my turn to give Sarissa an appraising look. Yeah, it does.
So why not?
Because you aren't a goddamn sex doll either.
Even if I were willing? She asked.
My stomach jumped a little at that. Sarissa was attractive as hell, and I liked her. I'd made her smile and laugh on occasion. And it had been a while. Man, story of my life. It seems like it's almost always been a while. But you have to think about more than what is going to happen in the next hour.
You're here because Mab ordered you to be here, I said. Anything we did would have an element of coercion to it, no matter how it happened. I'm not into that.
You saved my life just now, Sarissa said. Some people might think you'd earned my attentions.
People think stupid things all the time. The only opinion that matters is yours.
I glanced at her. Besides, you probably saved me right back.
Toting steel into the heart of winter, using it right in front of Mab herself, that's crazy.
She smiled a little.
It would have been crazy not to tote it, she said. I've learned a few things in my time here.
We had reached the doors to my suite, which still felt awkward to say, even in my own head. My suite. Guys like me don't have suites, we have lairs. Cat Sith had departed discreetly. I hadn't seen him go.
How long has it been? I asked.
Too long, she said. She hadn't taken her hand off of my arm.
You know, I said, we've been working together for a while now.
We have.
But we haven't ever talked about ourselves.
Not really. It's all been surface stuff.
You haven't talked about you, she said. I haven't talked about me.
Maybe we should change that, I said.
Sarissa looked down. There were points of color in her cheeks.
Should we?
You want to come in? I asked.
To talk, that's all.
She took a moment to choose her words.
If you want me to.
I tried to think about this from Sarissa's point of view. She was a beautiful woman who had to be constantly aware of male interest. She was a mortal living in a world of fairies, most of whom were malicious, all of whom were dangerous. Her introduction to the office of the Winter Knight had been Lloyd Slate, who had been one monstrous son of a bitch. She had some kind of relationship with Mab herself, a being who could have her destroyed at any moment she was displeased with Sarissa. And I was Mab's hatchet man. She'd been targeted for death for no better reason than that she happened to be my date at the party. She'd nearly died, yet she'd taken action to save herself, and me, too. And now here she was, standing calmly beside me, not showing the least anxiety. She'd spent months helping me get back on my feet again, always gentle, always helpful, always patient. She was wary about extending me any trust. She'd been holding herself at a careful distance. I could understand why. Caution was a critical survival trait in winter, and as far as she was concerned, I was most likely a monster in the process of being born. A monster she'd been given to, no less. Thinking about it, even if I had saved her life, it wouldn't have needed saving had she not been with me. I figured that between that and everything else she'd done for me, I was well in her debt. But I couldn't help her if I didn't know more about her.
For a couple of minutes, I said. Please.
She nodded and we went inside. I had a little living room outside of my bedroom. I read somewhere that in general, women tend to be more comfortable with someone sitting beside them rather than across from them. Men tend to be the opposite. Facing each other has undertones of direct physical conflict, in which a generally larger, stronger person would have an advantage. I didn't know whether it was true or not, but she was already keyed up enough, and I didn't want to add anything to it. So I seated her at one end of the couch, and then seated myself at the opposite end, out of arm's length.
Okay, I said. We haven't talked, I guess, because I've never told you anything about myself. Is that about the shape of it?
Trust has to go both ways, she said. I huffed out a short laugh.
You've been hanging around Mab too much. She's not big on answering simple yes or no questions, either.
Sarissa's mouth twitched at the corners.
Yes.
I laughed again.
Okay, I said.
Well, when in Rome, maybe we should exchange questions and answers. You can go first.
She folded her hands, frowning, and then nodded.
I've heard a lot of stories about you, that you've killed a lot of people. Are they true?
I don't know what you've heard, I said, but yeah. When bad things came after people in my town, I made it my business to get in the way. And I've been a warden of the White Council for a while now. I fought in the war against the Red Court. I've done a lot of fighting. Sometimes people get killed. Why are you in Mab's debt?
I have a form of congenital dementia, she said. I watched what it did to my older sister, and she shuddered. Doctors can't help me. Mab can. Have you ever killed anyone who wasn't trying to kill you?
I looked down at my shoes. Twice, I said quietly. I cut Lloyd Slate's throat to become the Winter Knight, and a flash of memory. A ruined city full of howling monsters and blood, flashes of light and roaring detonations of magic tearing asunder stone and air alike, dust everywhere, friends fighting, bleeding, desperate, a stone altar covered in a thick coating of dried blood, a terrified little girl, my daughter, treachery, a kiss pressed against the forehead of a woman I was about to murder.
God, Susan. Forgive me.
I couldn't see through the blur in my eyes, and my throat felt like the Red Cap might be garroting me again, but I forced myself to speak. And I killed a woman named Susan Rodriguez on a stone altar. Because if I hadn't, a little girl and a lot of good people would have died. She knew it, too. I swiped a hand at my eyes and coughed to clear my throat. What were the terms of your bargain with Mab?
That as long as I remained myself and sane, I would attend her and do as she bade me for 3 months out of every year. Summer vacation when I was in school. Weekends now, except for lately. Taking care of you meant that I'd have months and months off to make up for it.
She fidgeted with the bloodied handkerchief. Her split lip had stopped bleeding, and a line of dark, drying blood marred it.
The whole time we worked on your therapy, I think you said something about having a dog and a cat once, but you never spoke about any friends or family. Why not?
I shrugged. I'm not sure, I said. And then I realized that I was lying to everyone in the room.
Maybe because it hurts to think about them. Because I miss them. Because they're good people, the best. And I'm not sure I can look them in the eye anymore after what I've done. What about you? Do you have any friends?
There are people I sometimes do things with, she said. I'm not sure I'd call them friends. I don't want to make friends. I have the attention of some dangerous beings. If I got close to anyone, I could be putting them in danger. Don't you ever worry about that?
Every day, I said. I've buried friends who died because they were involved with my work and my life. But they wanted to be there. They knew the dangers and chose to face them. It isn't my place to choose for them. Do you think it's better to be alone?
I think it's better for them, Sarissa said. You're healthy now. Are you going to go home? To your friends and family?
Home isn't there anymore, I said, and suddenly felt very tired. They burned my apartment down, my books, my lab, and my friends think I'm dead. How do I just walk back in? Hi, everyone, I'm back, and did you miss me? I'm working for one of the bad guys now, and what good movies came out while I was gone?
I shook my head. I'm making fresh enemies, nasty ones. I'd be pulling them in all over again. I know what they'd say, that it didn't matter, but I don't know what I'm going to do yet. Mab seems to trust you. What is it that you do for her, exactly?
Sarissa smiled faintly. I'm sort of her humanity, Sherpa, she said. For all of her power and knowledge, Mab doesn't always understand people very well. She asks me questions. Sometimes we watch television or go to movies or listen to music. I've taken her to rock concerts. We've gone ice skating, shopping, clubbing. Once we went to Disneyland.
I blinked. Wait. Your job is... your BFFs with Mab? Sarissa let out a sudden torrent of giggles until her eyes started to water a little.
Oh, she said, still giggling. Oh, I've never thought of it like that, but... God, it applies, doesn't it? We do something every weekend.
She shook her head and took a moment to compose herself. Then she asked me,
Is there anyone special for you back home?
Karen. But I didn't dare use her name. No telling what other ears might be listening. Maybe, I said. It was sort of starting up when I left. I'm not sure where it would have gone. I'd like to think that... I shrugged. Well, it was bad timing on an epic level. You?
Nothing more than casual, she said. If I was close to someone, well, it would create a target for Mab's enemies, which I sometimes think is practically everybody in Faerie. Killing the lover of Mab's pet mortal would be an insult while remaining oblique enough to not allow her room to respond. She took a deep breath and looked at her hands. I saw you speaking to her on the dance floor. I saw your face. Who did she tell you to kill?
I hesitated.
I'm pretty sure I shouldn't say. It's information that could get you into trouble.
I looked up in time to see the wariness returning to Sarissa's features.
Ah, she said. Well, I suppose our little exchange is over, then.
She bit her lower lip and asked, quite calmly,
Was it me?
That one caught me off guard.
What?
No, it wasn't you. She didn't move for several heartbeats.
I see.
Then she looked up, gave me a pleasant and false smile, and said,
Well, it's late, and you should still try to rest as much as you can.
Sarissa, wait, I began. She rose, her back straight, her shoulders tense.
I think I'm going to my bed, unless you'd prefer...
I stood up with her. Don't think that I'm against the idea as a general principle. You're smart, and I like you, and you're gorgeous. But no, not like this. She chewed on her lip again and nodded.
Thank you for that, for understanding.
Sure, I said. I offered my arm and walked her back to the door of my lair. Lair worked so much better in my head than sweet. At the door, she looked up at me.
May I ask you a question?
Of course.
Are you going to obey, Mab?
My brain started gibbering and running in circles at the very thought of what Mab had asked me to do. But I forced it to sit down and start breathing into a paper bag, and then I thought about it for a second. Maybe. Maybe not.
Why?
She asked. I rocked back onto my heels. It felt like that one little word had thumped me between the eyes with a wiffle ball bat. Sarissa had hit exactly upon what most bothered me about Mab's command. Why? Why now, instead of 6 months ago, or a year ago, or 100 years ago? Why today, instead of tomorrow? Hell, why should I do it in the first place? The whole reason Winter and Summer had a night was because the Queens of Faerie themselves were forbidden from directly killing any mortal, and they needed a hitman to make it happen. But Maeve wasn't a mortal. As far as Mab was concerned, little Miss Spanglecrotch was fair game. Why?
I'm not sure yet, I said. But I'm damn well going to find out.
Chapter 9 Cat Sith, I called once Sarissa had left. From behind me, a voice said,
Yes, Sir Knight.
I twitched and didn't whirl around like a frightened teenager. I turned in a very urbane and James Bondian fashion, in keeping with my tux, eyed him and said, Hell's bells! Do you always come in like that?
No,
the Malk replied. He was sitting on the back of the sofa Sarissa and I had recently vacated.
Generally, I do not speak. I simply proceed.
Are you
aware of my orders? I asked.
I am aware that you are to be given orders. I am to facilitate your ability to comply with them.
I nodded. I need to get back to Chicago right now, and I need a car. Cat Sith turned and padded down the hallway toward my bedroom. He stopped in the hall at the door to the linen closet and lashed his tail once, then looked at me.
Very well.
I frowned at him, then I went to the closet and opened the door. Autumn air, humid and smothering compared to that of Arctis Tor, flooded into my lair. Brilliant light shone on the other side of the door, and it took me a few seconds of blinking against them to adjust and realize that I was being blinded by simple street lights. Inside my closet, there was a bit of sidewalk, and then Michigan Avenue stretching out to the storefront opposite. I blinked several times. Sith had opened a way between Ferry and Chicago. The spirit world, the Never Never, is vast, almost beyond imagining. Ferry is but one part of it, for the most part occupying the realms of spirit that lie most adjacent to the mortal world. The geography of the spirit world isn't like that of the real world. Different places in the spirit world will connect with places with a similar energy in the real world. So, dark, spooky parts of the Never Never hook up with dark, spooky places in the mortal world. And my freaking linen closet in Arctis Tor hooked up to Chicago. Specifically to Michigan Avenue, to the Gothic stone building across the street from the old historic water tower. It was night. Cars went by occasionally, but no one seemed to take notice of the open portal to the heart of winter. Arctis Tor was isolated in the Never Never, difficult to reach without inside help. Even traveling by ways takes at least some time, and I'd expected a hike back to the real world.
How? I asked quietly. Her Majesty had it made, Sith said.
I whistled. Intentionally forming a connection from a specific place to a specific place took amounts of energy so enormous that even the White Council of Wizards could rarely manage it. I'd seen it done only once in my lifetime, the year before, in Chichen Itza. She had it made? For me?
Indeed, Sith said. In fact, this is, for the time being, the only way in or out of Ferry.
I blinked several times. You mean winter?
Ferry,
Sith stated.
All of it.
I choked.
Wait, you mean all of Ferry is on lockdown?
Indeed,
Sith said.
Until dawn.
Why? I asked.
One presumes it was done to give you a head start.
With that, Sith walked calmly through the door and onto the sidewalk.
Your car, Sir Knight.
I stepped through the door into the Chicago air, and it slugged me in the face with a legion of scents and sensations and sounds that were as familiar to me as my own breathing. After the cool, dry silence of Arctis Tor, I felt like I'd leapt into the middle of an active circus. There were too many sounds, scents, too much color, too much motion. Arctis Tor was as still as the deepest night of winter, 24/7. Chicago is, well, Chicago. I found myself blinking my eyes very rapidly. Home. I know, it's corny. Especially since Chicago is what a polite person would call a colorful place. It's a den of crime and corruption, and it's a monument to architecture and enterprise. It's violent and dangerous and an epicenter of music and the arts. The good, the bad, the ugly, the sublime, monsters and angels, they're all here. The scents and sounds triggered a mental avalanche of memories, and I shivered at the intensity of it. I almost didn't notice the car that pulled up to the curb beside me. It was an ancient hearse, a caddy that must have been built sometime in the years immediately following World War II, complete with rounded tail fins. It had been painted dark, dark blue and given a flame job in shades of electric purple.
It wavered and bobbed drunkenly down the avenue, turned a bit too sharply toward the curb, lurched ahead with a roar of the engine, and then skidded to a halt with the brakes locked, missing the posts along the edge of the road and the chains that hung between them by maybe an inch.
"Will there be anything else, Sir Knight?"
Cat Sith asked. "Not right now," I said warily. "Who is driving that thing?"
"I recommend it be you,"
Sith said with unmistakable contempt, and then with a swish of his tail, he vanished. The engine roared once more, and the car lurched but didn't move from its rest. The lights went on and then off, and then the wipers swept on a few times before the engine dropped to an idle and the brake lights shut off. I approached the car warily, leaned across the chains, and rapped on the driver's side window. Nothing happened. The windows were tinted a little, enough to make the dark interior invisible on the well-lit street. I couldn't see anyone inside. I opened the door.
"Three cheers, boys!"
piped a tiny cartoon character voice.
"Hip, hip, hip!"
shrilled maybe a dozen more tiny voices.
"Hip, hip, hip! Hip, hip, hip!"
That was followed by a heartfelt chorus of,
"Yay!"
Sitting in the driver's seat of the hearse were a dozen tiny humanoids. Their leader, the largest of them, was maybe 18 inches tall. He looked like an extremely athletic youth, drawn down to scale. He was dressed in armor made from cast-off bits of garbage and refuse. His breastplate had been made from a section of aluminum can, a white one bearing a Coca-Cola logo. The shield on his left arm was made from the same material, this one sporting Coke's seasonal Christmas polar bears. Part of a plastic toothpaste travel container had been fixed to his belt, and what looked like a serrated butter knife was thrust into it, its handle wrapped in layers of duct tape and string. His hair was violet, silky, and nearly weightless, drifting around his head like dandelion down. Wings like a dragonfly's hung from his back like an iridescent cloak. He was standing atop a formation of smaller sprites, stacked up in a miniature human pyramid, and his hands rested on the wheel. Several weary-looking little wee folk were leaning against the gear shift, and several more were on the floor, holding the brake down in a dog pile of tiny bodies. They were all dressed in similar outfits of repurposed garbage. The leader gave me a sharp salute, beaming.
"Major General Toot Toot of the Sir Zar Winter Lord Knight's Guard, reporting for duty. It is good to see you, my lord."
His wings buzzed, and he fluttered out of the hearse to hover in front of my face, spinning in circles.
"Look, look, I got new gear."
"We're all winter and stuff,"
piped up one of the smaller members of the guard. He brandished his shield, which was made out of a section of plastic that had come from a solid-stick deodorant container bearing the words Winter Clean.
"Go, winter!"
shouted Toot, thrusting a fist into the air.
"Go, pizza!"
echoed the others. Toot spun around and scowled at them.
"No, no, no! We practiced this!"
"Go, pizza!"
they bellowed louder and more in unison. Toot Toot sighed and shook his head.
"This is why you're all colonels and I'm a major general. 'Cause you got corn silk in your ears."
Toot and company were kind of my minions. I'd gotten along well with the little folk over the years, mostly by virtue of bribing them with pizza. A few snitches and stool pigeons had developed into a band of cute little moochers, and then into an army. And at some point after that, Toot had somehow gotten the idea to make them into a real army. And they tried, they honestly did. But it's tough to form a disciplined military when most of the guys in it have an attention span about 20 seconds long. Discipline is boring.
Guys, I said, "break it up and shove over, I'm in a hurry."
The wee folk complied at once, all of them scrambling into the passenger seat or over into the rear compartment. I got in as quickly as I could and shut the door behind me. I buckled in and pulled out into the sparse traffic. The big caddy moved out with a satisfied rumble and way more power than I was used to in an automobile. My last car had been a vintage VW Bug, with an engine about the size of a deck of cards. Toot, I said, have you grown?
Yes,
Toot said, disgusted.
Even though I stand around with weights on